The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. The issues discussed today have not gone to trial, and no trier of fact, which means a judge or a jury, has made findings as it relates to the claims of the respective parties. Nothing herein is to be construed or used in lieu of any future findings made by the appropriate trier of fact with regard to the claims of the respective parties. Divorce, custody battles, domestic violence. These cases unfold every day in family courts. But the stories don't end in the courtroom. The courtroom is just the beginning. This is Love, Lust, Law, and I'm your host, Michelle Locke. I've spent 23 years practicing as a divorce attorney and presided over more than 5,000 cases as an associate court judge in Texas over a dedicated family violence court. I'm also the child of divorce, and after a 22-year marriage, I've been through one of my own. When I say I've lived every side of family law, I mean it. Now, I'm bringing the experience to the mic so we can unpack the legal battles fueled by love, lust, power, money, betrayal, and survival. Today, I'm joined by Jake Deptula, a seasoned victim advocate and podcaster, who just so happens to be my friend and my executive producer. He'll be by my side as I dive into one of the most explosive legal battles currently unfolding in Hollywood, Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni. What started as a highly anticipated film adaptation of It Ends With Us, a best-selling novel by Colleen Hoover, quickly turned into something no one saw coming. The project had everything going for it, a beloved book, a major distributor, and A-list talent leading the charge. But behind the scenes, tensions were already simmering. In this first episode of our two-part series, we're going to walk through what led up to Blake's initial legal action. We'll break down the film's release, the speculation about what went wrong, and the specific claims in Blake's complaint, including allegations of sexual harassment, retaliation, and a targeted smear campaign. In part two, we'll look at what happened next, Blake's follow-up lawsuit, Justin's response, and the legal strategies playing out on both sides. Now, we're not here to litigate guilt or innocence. That's for the judge and jury. But we're going to take a close look at the claims, the public reaction, and what this all says about power dynamics in Hollywood. Because when you strip away the celebrity and the headlines, what you're left with is a workplace dispute with real legal and reputational stakes. And it's a reminder that the image we're sold in Hollywood isn't always the full truth. We've got a lot to unpack. Let's get into it. In May 2023, filming began on It Ends With Us. The story centers on Lily, played by Blake Lively, a florist navigating a complicated and increasingly abusive relationship with neurosurgeon Ryle, played by Justin Baldoni. When her former boyfriend, Atlas, unexpectedly comes back into her life, everything shifts. Now, it's important to know that Justin Baldoni's production company, Wayfarer Studios, owned the rights to the story and was running the show while Sony was going to distribute the film when it was done. The New York Times reported that Wayfarer was bankrolled by billionaire Steve Sarowitz. Together, Steve and Justin served as co-chairs of the studio, while Jamie Heath held the role of CEO and lead producer. It Ends With Us was going to be their first major project, and they needed it to go well. Jake, you know, the legal world is kind of my territory, and the courtroom's kind of my territory, but the film industry, that's a new one for me. Can you explain what it means and how it works with the production company, the producer, and the co-stars? Like, how does that all fit together?
When it comes to the production company and the movie, if the production company has financing or has a distribution deal with a studio or a platform, it puts them in the power position. Most actors know that a production company or a producer has control over the ultimate say or the ultimate distribution of a movie. Actors take direction from directors. They are protected by the lawyers, the managers, the agents, but they can only go so far because ultimately, actors are at the mercy of the director, of the producers, of the production company, and of the studios to make them look their best, to keep the scenes they want in the movie. If they don't have final cut or they're not that top 1%, then they're literally at the mercy of all those people I just named off.
Wow. So if you look at this, Justin Baldoni was already in a power position times three. Would that be accurate? I mean, he was the director, he was the producer, he was the co-star, and then he had a financial interest with the production company?
It's a fair assessment. And the way you describe it sounds like a major conflict of interest. But technically, this is how movies work. This is how TV works.
I got to tell you, if this was in the law field, that would be a complete conflict of interest.
And that's the whole thing, too, in terms of he knew he had the power. I mean, most people aren't daft when it comes to understanding what dynamics they have and ultimately what control they have over the people that work for them. Because in this particular case, he was not a director for hire. He's the one who owned the property through his production company. So ultimately, whatever deal they had with the studio or the distribution platform ultimately boils down to that's part of the business. So everyone else is attached as an element, no matter what success level that they're at in this particular case. So even if, let's say, another actor was attached as producer, a lot of times that can be seen as a vanity credit and not someone who actually has voting power. But ultimately, in order to get a movie made, actors would like to have a producer credit. Doesn't mean that actors don't produce movies or produce movies based on the tradition of what producing is, but sometimes they are awarded a vanity credit in order to accept the role in a movie because it at least makes it seem from the outside that they have either done more or have more power. When in reality, at the end of the day, the voting rights are going to come down to who has the business deal in place for the actual making of, financing, and distribution of the movie.
So it's kind of like when we as lawyers pad our resume with all of the best lawyers in America and the recognitions and all those things that you can basically, I wouldn't say pay to get, but pay to get in some regards and add them to your resume to make you appear better than you are, I guess would be the way to say it. Sounds very similar.
I mean, basically, it's a case-by-case basis. And I think what's complicated things a little bit is when it comes down to accepting awards, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has certain mandates. Let's say a movie's in consideration for Best Picture at the Oscars. They have a rule about how many producers can actually receive an award. Three can be named. So let's say you have a movie with 20 producers. That's not uncommon in this day and age. So you have like four or five executive producers, four or five producers, associate producers. It goes coordinating producers, associate producers, supervising producers. It just goes on down the list, right? And everybody's at a different hierarchy. A lot of times executive producers aren't the people who step in and get the Oscar. It's usually the producer. So if you give, let's say, a talent, an actor, an executive producer credit, generally they will not be receiving an award for anything. It's generally the producers who put in the work to get the picture made. Now, that's a case-by-case basis, but generally in Hollywood, most people know who is an actual producer and who puts in the work to get the movie made and those who just want to collect the credits when it comes to producing.
That is very similar. I would compare that to what I do, which is everyone knows who the people that are truly litigators in the courtroom versus those that try to say they litigate but don't really go to court a whole heck of a lot.
100%. You're at the top of your game in your field, in your area, and you understand how that works. And I think that ultimately, people will grin and bear certain things. But at the end of the day, there's very few people who can take credit for getting a movie made from beginning to end.
Yeah, I mean, it takes probably a special talent and effort and knowledge set that is required to do those things, is my guess. I mean, I don't know. I'm now learning more about Hollywood in the last 3 minutes of this conversation than I knew my entire life.
Well, I mean, and to your point too, realize that if certain talent doesn't sign on to a movie, the movie will not get made. So talent knows ultimately they have the power as well. So a lot of things are going to be afforded to that talent in order to get them there because it's a puzzle. And really, it's easy to make a bad movie. It's very difficult to make a good movie. It's even more difficult to make a good movie that's a hit.
Wow, I'm learning so much. Should we get back to Blake and Justin?
Absolutely. Let's turn the script page on that.
All right. So fans of Colleen Hoover were excited for the movie. This was her first book to hit the big screen, and Blake Lively in the lead role only added to the anticipation. But production did not go as planned. A few months in, filming was suspended due to the Writers Guild of America strike. It didn't resume until January 2024 and officially wrapped the following month. In the spring, the promotional tour kicked off. There were pop-up events, interviews, red carpets, and press appearances. And suddenly, it wasn't just Hoover fans who were paying attention. The public was watching, too. And that may have had more to do with the cast than the actual content. You see, almost immediately, rumors of behind-the-scenes tensions started circulating. During press events, Blake and Justin appeared to be keeping their distance. And at the New York premiere on August 6th, the two stars didn't pose for photos together at all. In fact, Justin didn't spend time with any of the cast. He also didn't introduce the movie, even though he was the director. All this abnormal behavior fueled speculation that something had gone wrong, and the rumors kept spreading. It seemed like all anyone could talk about was Justin, Blake, and their alleged tension. Just 3 days later, on August 9th, It Ends With Us hit theaters. It was a box office success, grossing roughly $350 million worldwide. But even with that success, the conversation stayed focused on what might have happened behind the scenes. And most of that criticism was aimed at one person, Blake. Backlash against her began to skyrocket.
Blake was accused of being tone deaf, specifically for what some described as a lighthearted or humorous attitude in interviews. People were angry that she hadn't directly addressed the film's domestic violence themes or acknowledged the trauma her character experiences. The Hollywood Reporter wrote, "By glossing over its domestic violence content in the film's marketing and by not providing any content warnings prior to the start of the film, It Ends With Us ultimately fails the survivors it's supposed to advocate for." In response to the criticism, Blake shared an Instagram story voicing her support for victims of intimate partner violence. She also linked to the National Domestic Violence Hotline. But for many, it wasn't enough. And the backlash kept building.
Well, Jake, I can tell you when I first heard about it, you know what my first thought was?
What's that?
Who's filing suit first?
Well, that, I mean, from your perspective, that makes a lot of sense.
No, I mean, honest to God, I was like, oh, this is about to get ugly real fast. I mean, that's what I thought. I'm like, oh, this is going to go so poorly and someone's ending up getting sued. I didn't even think twice about it after that. I was like, well, I'll just wait for the lawsuit to get filed.
When I first heard about this, it made it sound like Blake was completely tone deaf. I agree with that in terms of what I heard with the media coverage. And we work in a survivor space, right? In terms of right. with domestic violence survivors, victims, people who have gone through a major amount of trauma. And so when I heard that, it was like someone who was, let's say, many saw furthering their career based on themes that ultimately they had no ability to use their platform or no desire to use their platform in order to amplify. So whether or not that was her obligation is arguable. But at the same point, I think that most people would say, if you have the opportunity to highlight something that you're participating in and something that could help a lot of other people, why wouldn't you do it? Now, granted, this was not a documentary. This was a fictional novel. It was something that was adapted in that sense. So who knows if her PR team, who knows if there was anyone in her circle that said, maybe you should take another step? Because that wasn't always the case. Let's be fair. With movies and TV, it's a relatively recent thing since the advent of social media that celebrities have to align themselves with an organization, have to align themselves with a cause based on the work that they're doing. Smart PR move, yes. But ultimately, a lot of times it comes down to a backlash like this in order to motivate them to take action. Blake may have thought that just by doing the film, that may have been enough. But I think until the backlash started, that's obviously when action was taken.
Oh, yeah. Because for months, the public didn't know what was really going on behind the scenes. Rumors had been circulating, but nothing was confirmed until December 20th, which is when everything changed. That day, Blake filed a complaint with the California Civil Rights Department. The filing, which was not a lawsuit, included screenshots of text messages and emails she obtained through a subpoena. She was seeking damages for sexual harassment, retaliation, failure to investigate, failure to prevent and/or remedy harassment, breach of contract, intentional infliction of emotional distress, negligence, false light invasion of privacy, and interference with prospective economic advantage.
In terms of the fact that this complaint is different from the lawsuit she filed on December 31st, is filing this complaint a legal strategy, PR, something more?
I can't tell you what her PR team's doing behind the scenes, because that's just not my forte. But I can tell you quite often you have to file, like if you have some kind of employment law claim, you have to file it with whoever the civil rights department is in your particular state to reserve your rights to file suit. So lots of states have the requirements that you've got to file with the civil rights department in whatever your respective state is. And you have to file with the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, on whatever your employment claims are. But because some of those agencies will issue you like a right to sue letter that you have to go to court.
According to the complaint, Blake had raised concerns about Justin even before filming began. After she signed on to the project based on a draft of the script, Justin allegedly inserted graphic content without her knowledge or consent, including a scene in which her character was to orgasm on camera.
So I don't know about this because, and this is something you may need to explain to me, Jake, is that permissible to change the script that she agreed to sign on to the project? Is that normal to change it without her knowledge or consent?
When an actor signs on a project, the caliber and status of Blake Lively, they may get script approval. Now, I don't know if that was the particular case in this situation, but generally speaking, minor tweaks, minor adjustments, scenes cut, scenes added, that's one thing. But I think in terms of this, it basically crosses the line because it puts her in an uncomfortable scenario, not something she signed on for, and not something that, let's say, was discussed with her, like without her knowledge or consent. He didn't sit down and say, okay, I really need to have this scene in here, explain to her why, but it seemed like something that may, for her, have come out of nowhere. And ultimately, it's something that she has got to be comfortable with. She didn't necessarily sign on for this. And I think that respect was not something primary when it came to doing this and basically surprising her with this. It's a very intimate situation, and she may not be comfortable doing that.
Whatever he added changed the movie from PG-13 to R, right? Like, that would not be...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's basically what he did, from what I can tell, or from the allegation, was that, I mean, he substantially changed it without her knowledge or consent, and it really changed the subject nature of the project, is what it sounds like.
It puts her in a position to be very uncomfortable, and in a way, before she's even getting the script, violated in the way, because again, she did not know and did not sign on for that. And I think that it's a very disrespectful thing, but I think considering the content of the scene, that it's definitely a violation of trust when it comes to the director-actor relationship.
Well, yeah, because when Blake found out that Justin was adding the gratuitous sex scenes to the script, she objected, and Justin responded that he had added the scenes because he was making the film through the female gaze. Although he agreed to remove them, he pushed to keep one in, which the couple orgasms together on their wedding night. He reportedly told Blake that the scene was important to him because he and his partner climax simultaneously during intercourse. Just as a side note, you don't ever discuss that in the context of a professional relationship. Like, we discuss in family law lots of inappropriate things because our facts include inappropriate things quite often, but we don't use our own life comparison to say, oh yeah, by the way, that's just weird. But then, according to the complaint, Justin asked Blake whether she and her husband Ryan Reynolds climaxed simultaneously, a question Blake found invasive and refused to answer. Man, I would have lost it if someone asked me that.
I don't care if it's in a creative context or not. Is there a major violation here when it comes to workplace? This is a workplace disaster.
It's an HR nightmare is what it is.
Yeah.
Once filming officially began in May 2023, Blake said things got worse. She described incidents where Justin talked openly about his sex life, including sexual encounters where he admitted he might not have received consent. Holy cow. She also alleged that both Justin and lead producer Jamie Heath repeatedly entered her makeup trailer uninvited while she was undressed, including during times when she was breastfeeding.
There were several other broad allegations, behaviors Blake said happened repeatedly, but I want to focus on some specific incidents that left her deeply uncomfortable. She claimed that in one scene, Justin discreetly bit and sucked on her lower lip. He had improvised repeated kisses and insisted on reshooting the scene over and over again, far beyond what she believed would be required on a typical set. None of it had been discussed in advance, and Blake said she did not give consent. On another occasion, they were filming a slow dance montage with no sound being recorded. Justin chose to stay physically in character, but not verbally. He leaned in, dragged his lips from Blake's ear down her neck, and said, "It smells so good." None of it was in the script. And with no audio being captured, there was no reason to speak at all. According to Blake's complaint, it was an uninvited and inappropriate moment that had nothing to do with the film. When she later objected, Justin allegedly said, "I'm not even attracted to you." Now, here is the one thing I do have to say about this particular scenario. You read this and you can say, these are actors, these are improvising. Maybe in the moment that it was fine, but later on it's being used in a complaint, in a court case, things like that. But you look at the building of the intimacy. You look at the trust. You look at things that it looks like Blake was not comfortable doing. So there's a very fine line when it comes to how behaviors on set translate to opportunities like this to exploit someone. If an actor had done this who was not the director, and an actor actress made a complaint, this would have been dealt with very differently. The fact that Justin, at this point, was her boss, was her director, was a lead actor, was a producer, was the production company partner, that put him in one of the most powerful positions on a movie. And Blake absolutely knew that.
On May 26th, Blake told a Sony representative she wanted to file an HR complaint about both Justin and Jamie's conduct. But she was told that because Sony was only the film's distributor, it didn't have the authority to step in. According to the representative, any misconduct on set had to be addressed with Wayfarer Studios, the production company in charge. Blake stated in her complaint that she raised her concerns directly with both Justin and Jamie more than once, but no investigation was launched and no protective measures were put into place. I look at this, Jake, because I look at conflict of interest all the time with what I do, and we have run conflict checks all the time. And she's having to go to complain to the person that's making her feel uncomfortable. He owns the company that's producing the movie. There's not going to be an investigation. Like, in-house, they weren't going to do anything because he runs the show. So she was in a really tough position. Let's say we believe these facts 100% because everyone says the truth. There's her version, there's his version, and the truth is somewhere in the middle. It's usually what it talks about when you're trying to get to the bottom of a story. Assuming what we've talked about so far is 100% true on Blake's side. What a miserable place for her to be in, and what would be, and it would be considered to me a hostile work environment. Like, I can't even imagine having to go to work to be with someone that you just did not feel comfortable with in any way, shape, or form. And that person was not only your boss, not only your co-actor, but also owned the production company that was producing your movie.
Even with her celebrity, even with the gravity of what she brings to the table, you feel like she was trapped and almost triangulated in a way at the center of something that she couldn't escape.
It goes back to what we talked about in some of our earlier episodes about Brad and Jennifer's divorce, or Brad and Angelina's. But at the end of the day, these are human beings, right, who are in a work environment because that's their job to go do every single day when they're working on set. And she's stuck in a position where she's miserable. And we talk now about mental health being one of the leading issues in the workplace now because of people are so unhappy at their jobs, or in some cases stuck in their jobs. And she's stuck. I mean, what is she going to do? Walk off the movie? Then she's in breach of contract and has a whole bunch of other problems going on? I mean, she's really stuck, and I sympathize with the position that she was in.
Well, I think also, too, is that when this first came out and when you first started hearing about things, how the media would shape certain stories and certain narratives were, oh, Blake didn't do anything for survivors. She hasn't done anything to bring awareness to survivors, but she's starring in this movie. Then when these complaints came out and things started to get out there, part of it, the narrative was that she's now becoming and bringing up other problems to sort of direct people in another direction from what people saw as her failings or her inability to amplify some of the themes or some of the things that they felt that she should be doing beyond the movie.
Well, right. And then it was, she wasn't really a victim.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, that became as part of the narratives. You know, she's supposed to be advocating for victims, but now she's making complaints that she was a victim, but the media spin was she's really not.
Yeah, 100%. And so this falls right into the play, the same kind of treatment, the same thing she was experiencing on set, the allegations. She was also being basically villainized by the media at the same time and by many people who just saw her, unfortunately, at this time, as a difficult actress.
Yeah, I mean, she was not painted in a good light. When all this started bubbling, it was, she's the problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
So like we talked about earlier, filming paused in mid-June because of the writer's strike. But by November, the strike was over and the cast was preparing to resume production. Hoping to make things better on set, Blake's attorneys provided Wayfarer's legal team with a document titled Protections for Return to Production. In it, Blake requested that Wayfarer agree to a formal plan that would allow everyone to return to work safely with adequate measures in place to ensure a respectful and secure environment moving forward. The proposal included 17 specific provisions aimed at stopping the behaviors that had made Blake and others uncomfortable. One provision required an intimacy coordinator to be present on set. Another stated that no one was to enter, attempt to enter, interrupt, or request access to Blake's trailer while she was in a state of undress for any reason. There was also a clause explicitly prohibiting any form of retaliation against Blake for raising concerns or requesting these protections. One additional provision called for an all-hands meeting to take place in January before filming resumed to confirm and approve a plan for how the protections would be enforced.
On November 11th, Wayfarer's counsel responded in writing, "Wayfarer Sony and Production respectfully acknowledge that your client has concerns regarding safety, professionalism, and workplace culture. Although our perspective differs in many aspects, ensuring a safe environment for all involved is paramount, irrespective of differing viewpoints. Regarding your outlined requests, we find most of them not only reasonable, but also essential for the benefit of all parties involved." 4 days later, on November 15th, Wayfarer formally agreed to the terms in a contractual writer. Michelle, can you break all this down?
Oh, I sure can. But what I first want to point out is I think it's interesting that when she complained to Sony, Sony said it couldn't do anything because it was only the distribution company. But yet, when Wayfarer's counsel responded to Blake's people, they said Wayfarer, Sony, and production respectfully acknowledge. That was one interesting to me for several reasons, because now all of a sudden Sony is actually involved. But what it basically means is Wayfarer and Sony and production basically said, we're going to agree to a contract, but we're not admitting that we did anything wrong. And that can be seen when they say that although our perspective differs in many aspects, that's them saying, we don't agree with your allegations. That being said, your requests are not unreasonable given the circumstances, and so we'll go ahead and do them. And it benefits everyone. So it was really not even an admission that anything was wrong, but just, yeah, your requests are reasonable, so we'll do them. That's basically what happened. So they entered into a contract of some sort where Wayfarer formally agreed to the terms that she had requested. The January all-hands meeting was attended by key stakeholders in the film, as well as Blake's husband, Ryan Reynolds, who was present as her representative. His attendance had been agreed upon back in November. At the meeting, they reviewed the inappropriate conduct that Blake, her team, and other cast and crew members said they experienced, behavior they alleged came from both Justin and Jamie. After going through the list in full, everyone in the room agreed the conduct would stop. They signed off on 30 provisions, including the ones we mentioned just a second ago, but there were others. No more showing nude videos or images of women to Blake or her employees. No more improvised kissing or adding in sex scenes without Blake's approval. All intimate contact had to be choreographed in advance with an intimacy coordinator. Sony was expected to play an active, daily role in overseeing the remainder of the production, and there could be no more retaliatory or abusive behavior toward Blake for raising concerns or requesting safeguards. Some of the other provisions were highly specific. Justin was no longer allowed to say he'd been speaking to Blake's late father. He wasn't allowed to sage her employees. And there could be no more private multi-hour meetings in Blake's trailer with Justin crying unless a representative was present to monitor. What in the world? What is this about that? And maybe, Jake, if you know, I don't know. He was crying in her trailer for hours? What? So the boss, her leading man, the director, producer, and part owner of the company was in her trailer for hours crying? What?
There was some sort of psychological formulated connection that he was trying to make, whether he was doing it for the film, whether he was geared towards confessing or feeling guilty or doing something that ultimately caused him to break down based on the stress, or if it was a ploy. This is very abnormal behavior. Not to say that it doesn't happen. Many boundaries were crossed here. And you see it's very clear that at this point, that the allegations are being taken way more seriously by all the entities involved because they know ultimately what could be coming. And the fact that Blake had documented this, the fact that she had turned to all these people, all these organizations, and the fact that a complaint was filed really does go a long way at this point.
Well, yeah, I also find it really interesting that Sony is now, okay, we'll oversee the production now. I find that part odd, especially when in the beginning they're like, it's not our problem. Because that's basically what they did at the beginning.
They were trying to keep their hands clean, but ultimately they're going to end up taking the brunt of it, usually when it comes to marketing the film, when it comes to distributing the film. They are very well aware of how PR can ultimately impact a film's revenue, the perception of what went on, and ultimately what kind of conditions that any employees, anyone working under that banner could be subject to this kind of behavior and this kind of alleged abuse.
Wow. It baffles me. You know, when I look at cases and what I do, you look at behaviors, I look at patterns. I usually, in my divorces, try and get to like the root of the problem, right? Because when a couple comes to see you and they're getting divorced, that's been brewing for a while. But there's usually like an underlying reason of, or like the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back, or like some basic reason why they hate each other at that point and are ready to get divorced. There's usually something. And I try and get to the bottom of it. But I look at this and go, where did the bottom of this start? Like, where did Justin start to believe that his behavior was okay? Because what it appears to me, based on the facts that you and I have discussed so far, is that his behavior seemed to escalate. And it wasn't just directed at Blake, because it looks like there were other employees that had similar complaints, but it really seemed that he got away with a little bit or had some not as bad inappropriate behavior, but then it just kind of started to escalate as the filming went on.
After signing the list of 30 provisions, production resumed the next day. It wrapped just over a month later on February 9th. The New York Times reported that by the spring, Blake was telling people she worked with that Justin and Jamie's behavior had improved under the new productions, but now she was in a creative battle with them. With support from Sony, the film's distributor, Blake made her own cut of the movie. She brought in her own editors, hired a composer, and added one of Taylor Swift's songs. In the end, Sony and Wayfarer went with Blake's version, and she received a producer credit. Now, I can tell you this, is that it is very common, as I mentioned earlier, for talent to get a producer credit. What is very uncommon is the shift from both the distributor and the production company and the director to go with the lead talent's version of a movie.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because when I heard that there were two versions of the movie and the company went with Blake's version, it left me scratching my head going, wait, what?
It's shocking for a variety of reasons. And I think the one thing before we knew any of this stuff that had, let's say, come out in the way that it did is that it's like ceding control over the film. And you see how important this was, at least to Justin Baldoni, at least to his team, at least everything else, of power, of control, of vision, of doing things that ultimately creatively would execute what they had in their head based on the original material in order to get this made. Now, if I were to look at this from an analytical level, I would say two things. Not knowing what we know now, but let's say what we didn't know back then. Number one, Blake is in a very powerful position to promote or not promote the film, okay? To good mouth or bad mouth the film. So if that was the case, and if she was not making necessarily just a creative play, but a power play to say, I'm going to do this. This is the way I want to get this done. I'm going to sort of mute a lot of the discomfort, violating, abusive behavior that I've already made complaints about. And the only way this is going to remedy that is if I get control over this now to make the movie that I believe should be made in the way that it should be made. That's a very rare thing, to be fair. I mean, it's happened before. It happened in American History X when Edward Norton basically took over the movie from the director, Tony Kaye. But Tony Kaye was battling with the studio. He was battling with the talent. He was battling with everybody at the time. So Edward Norton took over the movie and actually made his own cut, and that's the one they went with. However, that battle was carried out in the media both the director and the actors were placing ads. This was way before social media. So it was like you'd see one ad on one page of the Hollywood Reporter and it would be little messages to each other. And they would take out these ads about who's destroying the film, who's jeopardizing this.
Oh, I love it. It's like the back pages.
It really was. It really was. It was a print war.
Wow.
But these are very rare circumstances. So this particular one, if you think about it, what Sony saw in her in order to have her take the cut of the movie and basically put a team together to say, Blake, have at it. I find that very telling in a way. Obviously, her version worked, but it's very rare.
Well, I'll say based on the sales, her version worked, number one. Number two, my thought, we talk about getting to the crux of the fight, right? Why did Sony do this? Did Sony do it because they wanted to make her happy so she would promote the film and they ended up liking her cut, so they used it? But how much of that was an attempt to, like, okay, you've made these complaints, you want to recut this, you're not happy with some of the scenes, here, go edit it, we'll let you edit it, and we'll pick a version, and they used her version. So how much of that was a mea culpa by the studio, by Sony? The other thought would be, well, now I understand Justin is now, I almost like to say, like the rejected lover, because he had this passion project he made. I mean, he was the director, he was the lead actor, and his cut didn't get used.
Well, you see how many lines are being blurred here?
Oh, yeah.
At this point, the movie's not even out yet.
Well, what I love about this is this has like, it's a bad divorce.
Yeah, it feels like that.
I mean, that's what it is. It's a bad divorce. And by this point, the movie was ready for release. It was scheduled to hit theaters in August. But according to Blake's legal complaint, in the months leading up to the film's debut, several key events unfolded. In May, Justin discovered that Ryan Reynolds had blocked him on Instagram. Lord have mercy. He texted his publicist, Jennifer Abel, "We should have a plan for if she does the same when movie comes out. Plans make me feel more at ease." Around the same time, the official promotion plan had been released to the cast. According to Blake's complaint, the plan, approved by Wayfarer, instructed the cast to focus on the more uplifting elements of the movie rather than its depiction of abuse. It also encouraged them to lean into a floral theme since Blake's character owns a flower shop. The marketing plan, along with the related talking points, explicitly directed Blake and all other cast and crew involved in promotions to focus more on her character's strength and resilience as opposed to describing the film as a story about domestic violence, and to avoid talking about this film that makes it feel sad or heavy. It's a story of hope.
Then, Blake and several cast members informed Sony and Wayfarer that they would not participate in any press appearances with Justin. The Times reported that author Colleen Hoover said the same thing. She already had her own frustrations with Justin. But according to subpoenaed texts between Justin and Jamie, she became even more upset after Justin told her about Blake's allegations. The complaint stated that Justin and everyone else publicly embraced that approach. From May through July, he participated in lighthearted promotional events centered around flowers and said nothing about the film's central themes of domestic violence.
In June, about a month after Justin's first promotional appearance for the film, Blake and other cast members fulfilled their first publicity obligation. Justin wasn't present. They didn't mention the misconduct that had allegedly occurred on set. And according to the complaint, no one on the cast ever told Wayfarer or Justin that they planned to speak publicly about their concerns. Still, on June 20th, Justin's publicist, Jennifer Abel, texted Jamie, "We can't have fans starting to guess why JB is left out of this stuff." The message sent off alarm bells. According to the complaint, Justin and Jamie became increasingly worried that the issues Blake had raised the previous fall and winter might soon come to light and damage their reputations, and quite frankly, ruin the movie that they needed to be successful.
Justin and Jamie were allegedly so concerned about what was going on that in late July, they hired Melissa Nathan, the crisis PR expert who had previously handled public relations for Johnny Depp during the Amber Heard trial.
Well, that was a smart tactical move because that PR team made Johnny look like a rock star. I mean, really, that PR team did one amazing job for Johnny Depp.
Michelle, as a lawyer, when you see someone gravitating towards a famous or let's say infamous PR team who understands how to handle crisis, what does that do in terms of understanding what kind of trouble they're in or what kind of help that they need support in when it comes to that legally?
It's interesting. People's moves and choices and selections always tell you a lot about what they're thinking. But if they were really worried about some of the allegations coming to light, what you do is a couple things, legal strategy-wise, is you get ahead of it or you put a turtle shell on it. And I talked about that before, about when you've got a problem, you try and cover it with that turtle shell as much as you can, or put lipstick on a pig as much as you can. And if you can't do that, then you quietly handle it so it goes away. Or in what their case, I think what they did is they got ahead of it. They said, let's get out in front of this so that we're protected or we've got our spin before anyone else gets a chance to drop their bombshell. And so I think that's smart. And when you have something that you know could publicly go really south, then you go hire the best.
I think the same thing can be said about hiring a lawyer.
It's very true.
When someone hires a particular lawyer based on their case history, you kind of know what kind of condition they're in.
You prepare for the worst, hope for the best, and hope isn't a tactic. And so if you're going into litigation or going into what potentially could be a PR crisis, or you're potentially getting divorced, you should go hire the best, the ones that are capable and have been in the trenches and done it. Because if they've been in the trenches, they know what works and they know what doesn't work. And those are the people that your livelihood is going to be contingent upon them being successful in their strategy. So you want to make sure you get the right one. Like the last thing you want, I'm sure, as a PR team, the last thing you want as a divorce attorney is you don't want to be in the courtroom or on the other side of your PR people with your reputation in ruin saying, man, I should have hired someone different. Like there's things you cheap out on in life and there's things you don't. Like you don't cheap out on a mattress. You don't. You spend half your life in bed, so you don't cheap out on a mattress. You don't cheap out on a PR team or a lawyer. On August 2nd, 1 week before the theatrical release, crisis PR expert Melissa Nathan sent a planning document to Justin and his team. It included suggested media talking points, one of which framed Blake as using an imbalance of power to take creative control of the film. But Justin wasn't satisfied. Not in love with the document they sent, he wrote in a group chat with Jennifer and Jamie. Not sure I'm feeling the protection I felt on the call. Jennifer relayed his concerns to Melissa. I think you guys need to be tough and show the strength of what you guys can do in these scenarios. He wants to feel like she can be buried. Melissa replied, of course. But you know, when we send over documents, we can't send over the work we will or could do because that could get us in a lot of trouble. We can't write, we will destroy her. Imagine if a document saying all the things that he wants ends up in the wrong hands. You know we can bury anyone. Holy cow, this goes back to my Exhibit A, don't put anything in writing if you don't want to go in front of a court or in the public forum. But for him to write or her to write what they wrote, we will destroy her. Holy cow.
This goes back to how the mafia used to communicate, or at least how it was depicted in films, where in Goodfellas, it was like, don't talk on the phone. Then in other mafia movies, it's like, don't write anything down. And then it was, I don't take calls. You've got to tell this person. They tell me they're the only direct contact. So the mafia tend to have it down pretty pat. I think that we're very used to seeing people's digital information being utilized in court. I think anybody who follows trials, anybody who follows true crime, and when people send certain things, I know this even from the experience that I have with Strictly Stalking and other shows, is how many heated, destructive, toxic, and dangerous texts get sent back and forth. I think people feel because it's on their phone, there's a privacy and there's also privacy laws that are going to protect them. I think when Snapchat came out and people were like, oh, it disappears. No, once it's digital, it's there forever. There is enough forensic digital technicians that you've discussed in court. These people are hired.
I've had to hire those experts.
Yes, they understand every single thing. So I think that the only thing that at this point we don't have is what's going on in our mind, but that may change soon enough. So,
oh, don't go there.
It's Minority Report. Minority Report.
No. I'm going to give you a throwback. Johnny Mnemonic.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. And explain for anyone who is not of that century, please describe.
Not of that century? Well, Jake, you are of that century.
I didn't claim not to be. I better be.
But Johnny Mnemonic was a Keanu Reeves movie where he had some chip implanted in his head. I don't even remember why. Now I'm going to have to go home and watch the movie again. But I remember going to the theater with a guy that I liked named Trent Stoker back in, like, I was a senior in high school lifeguarding. We were all going off to college. Oh, I'll never forget that. Anyways, wow, that's a memory.
According to Blake's complaint, Melissa was ready with a plan. She floated proposals to hire contractors who could dominate social media. These included what she described as full social account takedowns, the creation of threads of theories, and efforts to change narrative. All of this will be, most importantly, untraceable, she added.
That's scary for lots of reasons, but we'll get into that later. But it doesn't appear that Jennifer said yes right away. On August 4th, she texted Melissa, "I'm having reckless thoughts of wanting to plant pieces this week of how horrible Blake is to work with, just to get ahead of it." Melissa responded that she had already spoken off the record to an editor at the Daily Mail. "She's ready when we are," she wrote. She also texted that her sister was working on strategic stories for other outlets, including Page Six. According to the New York Times, some journalists had gotten wind of the complaints about Justin's behavior, but none of the most serious ones were published. On August 6th, the movie premiere occurred, and the media immediately picked up on the fact that Justin was not with the rest of the cast. That's when Blake alleges Justin decided to pivot. He moved away from the film's original marketing plan, a campaign focused on hope, empowerment, and Blake's character's resilience. Instead of highlighting female strength, he shifted the narrative to center on female trauma. He was the only one drifting away from the marketing plan, which left Blake and others looking like they were insensitive to domestic violence issues. Blake's complaint alleges that Justin changed his Instagram profile, canceled lighthearted social media posts, and instructed his team to look for survivors' reactions and support all in an effort to quickly shift his own public narrative to focus solely on survivors and domestic violence organizations. Justin's publicist, Jennifer, cautioned that the shift might be too drastic too soon. Still, Justin insisted on a TikTok strategy and that his promotional activities for the movie should seek to amplify what he described as survivor content.
Text messages show that at one point, Justin even told his team to start posting private messages survivors had sent him about abuse they suffered. Thankfully, they told him that wasn't a good idea.
That is offensive on so many levels, and tells me that he has no idea about what survivors go through, that he would be even willing to do that.
100%. Really counterintuitive to the sensitivity and the emotion that someone should have when dealing with survivors or people in general. And it shows his level of manipulation and how he has probably betrayed so many of these relationships in order to push his own narrative and utilize the energy and the spirit of overcoming and recovering from trauma in order to make himself look like a champion and an advocate for victims, which is very disturbing and very disgusting.
Just to put it lightly. And on August 7th, just one day after the premiere, Jennifer texted Melissa, "I think we need to put the social combat plan into motion." Melissa responded, "So do I." The team began working with Jed Wallace, whose company, Street Relations, offered everything from public relations to more opaque crisis management. The Times reported that Jed had very little digital footprint, but in his LinkedIn profile, he described himself as a hired gun with a proprietary formula for defining artists and trends.
The New York Times reported that it's still unclear exactly how Jed operated, but internal emails reference social manipulation and proactive fan posting. Text cited efforts to boost and amplify online content that supported Justin or targeted Blake. Blake's complaint stated, "This plan went well beyond standard crisis PR. What Melissa proposed, including a practice known as astroturfing, which had been defined as the practice of publishing opinions or comments on the internet, in the media, that appear to come from ordinary members of the public, but actually come from a particular company or political group.
According to Blake's complaint, Justin's team continued communicating their plans through text. On August 9th, the day the movie was released, Jed messaged Melissa, "We are crushing it on Reddit." That same day, Melissa texted Jennifer about how she had kept Blake's allegations out of the press. Jennifer asked, "So are we in the clear now? Did we survive?" Melissa responded, "We survived. All press is so overwhelming. We've confused people. So much mixed messaging. It's actually really funny if you think about it." The next day on August 10th, Melissa wrote to Jennifer, "And socials are really ramping up. In his favor, she must be furious. It's actually sad because it just shows you how people really want to hate on women." Then in another message, she added, "He doesn't realize how lucky he is right now. The whispering in the ear, the sexual connotations, like Jesus fucking Christ, other members feeling uncomfortable watching it. I mean, there is just so much."
At another point that day, Jennifer texted Melissa, "The narrative online is so freaking good and fans are still sticking up for Justin. And there literally has been no pickup of those two articles, which is actually shocking to me. But I see this as a total success, as does Justin. You did amazing work." Melissa replied, "Narrative is crazy good. So did you. The majority of socials are so pro-Justin, and I don't even agree with half of them, LOL."
That last text when I read, I remember reading it in the media. I laughed so hard. I mean, and let's start with what they are saying is offensive, appalling, and what they did, if they really did this coercive campaign to really try and take, you know, Blake out by her knees, that's horrific. But when they say the majority of our socials are so pro-Justin and I don't even agree with half of them, when your own team doesn't like you, because from those text messages, it's clearly, yeah, he's really lucky because all of, you know, there are these complaints and no one's picking up on it. Like, he dodged a bullet. I mean, even when your team knows you've dodged a bullet, at some point, you should just sit there and be thankful and be quiet and go away. But that's not what he did.
Well, you know what's really interesting, disturbing, and insightful about this particular scenario is it really does open up the public's eyes to how PR can work and how PR can saturate social media channels and confuse and send mixed messages. You look at how much news media, how much politics, how much entertainment, and how it's all kind of sort of converging at the same place in a way. And news cycles are so much shorter now. And all it takes is a very broad comment sometimes to stir this up. And I think that you look at the masterful work that PR teams do, but also in this case, very nefarious and things to basically damage and ruin reputations. And so by the time it gets out there, I mean, careers have been killed for less.
Right. I mean, careers have been killed for much, much less and for things that aren't true.
Yeah.
You know, so according to Blake's complaint, as the days passed, Justin continued working closely with the PR team, sometimes flagging specific social media posts he wanted them to use. On August 15th, he proposed flipping the narrative on a positive article about Blake and Ryan. At other times, he seemed to hesitate. When a tabloid published a critical piece about Blake, Justin sent a text, "How can we say somehow that we are not doing any of this? It looks like we are trying to take her down." I really want to say, duh, Captain Obvious. But by mid-August, the team appeared to be openly reveling in the backlash. On August 16th, Melissa shared a Daily Mail article with the headline, "Is Blake Set to be Canceled?" The piece included references to hard-to-watch videos and a tone-deaf promotional Q&A. Jennifer responded, "Wow, you really outdid yourself with this piece." Melissa replied, "That's why you hired me, right? I'm the best. And modest, too." Oh, and modest is not part of the quote. That was my additional commentary. Typically, you don't go around saying you're the best because the best don't need to say that. That's a whole different story, though. It seems Blake suspected that a smear campaign was underway because before the end of August, he hired a brand marketing consultant to evaluate the online fallout. The consultant concluded that Blake had likely been the target of a targeted multi-channel online attack, similar to the one waged against Amber Heard. And as she feared, it was damaging her reputation. The report didn't identify who was behind the effort, but by analyzing the entirety of Google's search index for Blake's name, it found that 35% of the results also included a reference to Justin. That number was highly unusual, especially given the length and visibility of Blake's career. The company said it strongly suggested that the media environment around her was being manipulated.
I want to note the second report, this one from Blake's own hair care brand, Blake Brown, reached a similar conclusion. The company had launched in August with record-breaking sales, but by the end of the campaign, its estimated losses of up to 78%, largely due to the online backlash.
Wow. Can I tell you, I don't know how much this lawsuit would have happened if that hadn't affected her bottom line pocketbook. Like if she had a business that was doing really well, and then by the end of it, it had a loss of 78% in profitability or revenue, yeah, I'd probably file suit too.
This is the danger of having a public face representing or building or establishing a company, because it rises and sinks based on the reputation and the online perception of the figurehead or of the face of the organization, if they're actually an active part of that organization, not being hired as an ambassador or representative to promote the brand.
Right, because Nike can always fire people that aren't doing well for their brand, right? But if it's your own brand, you're stuck.
We've seen things happen a lot quicker nowadays. From the moment somebody does something online to the time that the brand actually cuts ties, it used to be different before social media. It used to be in a position where someone would give a bad interview or someone would say something in the press or someone actually did something, and they'd pretty much cut ties right away. Now there's usually investigation. There's usually a little more time. They figure out, should we stand behind this person? Because also, too, realize back then, it was not easy to measure completely the power of a personality, but now through social media, now through online commentary, perception indexes, you can do that. But also if you have something like a PR team who's basically actively ruining or polluting the narrative of someone, that's a whole different story. So that's not necessarily obviously public perception, but it's leading public perception, because at the end of the day, they're not doing anything to ruin or tamper with the brand, but they're ruining the customer's perception of that person and that brand. And that's what ultimately affects the bottom line.
Yeah, it sure does. While Blake's public image was quickly deteriorating, Justin appeared to move through the same months without consequence as the allegations against him remained under wraps. The New York Times reported that in December, It Ends With Us was added to Netflix, and Justin kicked off a fresh round of press appearances. In an interview with Access Hollywood, he said, "There is never an excuse to hurt a woman physically or emotionally. We men have to step up and figure out how we can be better allies." That same month, he was honored at a star-studded event celebrating men who elevate women, combat gender-based violence, and promote gender equality worldwide. Things seemed to be going very well for Justin. But then, on December 20th, Blake filed a formal complaint against Justin, and everything changed. Following the complaint being filed, Blake released a statement. "I hope that my legal action helps pull back the curtain on these sinister, retaliatory tactics to harm people who speak up about misconduct and helps protect others who may be targeted."
The very next day, the New York Times published a detailed account of the allegations. The headline read, "We can bury anyone inside a Hollywood smear machine." When asked for comment about the allegations made in the complaint, Wayfarer's attorney, Brian Friedman, told the Times that the studio, its executives, and its PR representatives did nothing proactive nor retaliated against Blake. He called the complaint another desperate attempt to fix her negative reputation. "These claims are completely false, outrageous, and intentionally salacious, with an intent to publicly hurt and rehash a narrative in the media." Freeman didn't address any of the misconduct allegations related to Justin or Jamie during filming. Instead, he accused Blake of planting negative and completely fabricated and false stories about Justin in the media. According to him, that, more than anything, was what prompted Wayfarer to hire a crisis PR firm.
Oh, what do these statements tell me about the lawyer? Oh, lawyers have a tough job, right? Because we're hired to represent our clients. And so we're officer of the court. So we're supposed to have candor with the court. Of course, the statement wasn't to a court. Either he didn't know the facts, wasn't privy to all the detailed information, or just put out a statement that was patently false. But it wouldn't surprise me, because I know I've had it happen to me, at least in the courtroom, where something comes out, like on the witness stand, and I turn and look at my client and go, is that accurate? Actually, I don't actually ask them that in court. I write it down and pass them a note very nicely and say, is what they're saying true? And they send back the note and say, yes. And then I want to send an expletive note back to them going, well, why didn't you tell me? Because he may not have known about the details or the text messages before he made this statement. That would be my best guess. Because if he knew about the statements, I would be willing to bet that his public statement would have been a whole lot different. The New York Times article marked the first serious public blow to Justin's reputation, and it hit hard. That same day, WME, the talent agency that had represented Justin, dropped him. Celebrities began speaking out in support of Blake. Gwyneth Paltrow, Amber Heard, all of Blake's Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants co-stars, others followed. Sony Pictures released a public statement standing by Blake saying, we strongly condemn any reputational attacks on her. Any such attacks have no place in our business or in a civil society. For Blake, it finally felt like the tide had turned. But this was only the beginning. In part two, we'll get into the lawsuit Blake filed against Justin, his response, and everything that happened next. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. I'll be back with a brand new episode. And remember, there are lots of four-letter words in family law, and fair isn't one of them. Until then, I'm Michelle Locke, and this is Love, Lust, Law. Love, Lust, Law is hosted by me, Michelle Locke. Jake Deptula is executive producer. Haley Gray is producer, writer, and researcher. Jared Landis is sound editor and mixer. Want to reach out to me? You can. You can email me at hello@michellelocke.com. Want to find out what I'm up to? You also can on Instagram by following me at Attorney Michelle Locke. Just remember, Michelle is spelled with one L, and you can thank my mother, Margot, for that.